From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Coming up, we'll hear about a small piece of metal that's keeping taxi drivers from being able to leave the industry.
All the negative things that we were warning was going to happen if they start selling medallions has been happening.
Then we'll talk with the reporter who investigated the Richmond-based meal kit company, Blue Apron.
Compared to other startups in the meal kit industry that we looked up, Blue Apron had more violations and more fines than any of these other companies.
And we'll hear why singing in a senior choir is...
It's a sense of camaraderie, you know, enjoyment, and you feel elated.
Good news, music keeps us young. That's up next on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Taxi drivers have been feeling the pinch from ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft for years at this point. One of the biggest differences between those startups and cabs is that taxi drivers need a permit called a medallion to operate. San Francisco has a complex history with its medallions, and many cabbies are angry about what they say are out-of-date regulations. KALW's business and economics reporter Jeremy Dalmas hailed down some drivers to find their story.
Her beer bat isn't having a good day.
Oh, it's been terrible.
Terrible?
Yeah.
Not a lot of rides?
Finally, some hope appears. A doorman for the Park 55 Hotel in Union Square hails the cab over to pick up a fare.
Dude, which one is it? Where?
North Beach.
North Beach, right? It's close by.
Yeah.
Bat lives in Berkeley and has been driving for over 20 years.
I come from like northern India, and I have a family, wife and two kids, 18-year-old and a 10-year-old daughter.
And he has a taxi medallion. That should mean he's made it as a driver. A medallion is a license to operate a taxi. It's on the dashboard, and it looks like a small red license plate with a number punched in bold print right in the middle.
Yeah, it's right here. Yeah, this, if you pull it out, and this is the number that makes it a medallion. 1317.
1317?
Yeah.
That thin piece of metal makes this a genuine San Francisco taxi. And each cab you see driving down Market Street has to have one. To keep from having too many cabs on the road, the city only issues about 2,000 of them. If a driver doesn't own a medallion, they have to rent one from a driver who does. And if you do own one, you get to make extra cash. Once you have it, it's like you're a small business owner. It turns driving a taxi into a solid blue-collar job. Bat had to take out a loan to buy his medallion. It cost him $250,000 back in 2012.
I got a letter like saying, if you are willing to buy, this is the price, you got to put like 20% down. So I just got like money from my friends, you know, family, and you know, that's how I got my down payment and got this.
But it was right after he got the medallion that, maybe you guessed, Uber and Lyft took off and started to nab many of the fares that Bat would have gotten. Before he got his medallion, he made around $25 or $30 an hour. Now that he has it, his income should have gone up.
Minimum wage, it doesn't even give you a minimum wage. You'll be lucky when you make like some days $7, $8. That's the average there most of the drivers are making.
And he's stuck. To get rid of the medallion and get out of the industry, another taxi driver has to buy it off of him. It's like he has a mortgage on a house and he needs to move out, but he can't find a buyer. There aren't many people who want to drop $250,000 for a San Francisco taxi medallion right now. There used to be a waiting list to get one. Drivers would wait 10, 15, sometimes close to 20 years. Bat waited 12. Now, drivers see them as a liability. And there's a waiting list to sell medallions. And until he gets to the top of that list, Bat has to keep staring at that medallion on his dashboard every day as he drives.
I'd rather do anything else with my life than this rundown, you know, or dying industry, which there's no future like, and this, now I'm hanging in, but I really don't know how long I'll be able to do that. It couldn't be forever.
Decades ago, medallions were open to the free market. They cost whatever someone was willing to pay for them. Then, in 1978, San Francisco voters made medallions free. Drivers started to earn them just by being on the waiting list, meaning no $250,000. This was the system for over three decades, until around 2012. If Bat had gotten his medallion a few years earlier, he wouldn't be stuck with monthly payments on this huge loan.
So this is Little Italy, and I don't know where you guys want to get off.
There's a restaurant with a minimal line.
No, they're all these are really good restaurants. There's a Rose Pistola. Rose Pistola is pretty good.
Good luck. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
So why did the San Francisco MTA start charging for the medallions? Seemingly, the timing couldn't have been worse. It was finalized just 2 months after Lyft launched. Barry Korengold is co-founder of the San Francisco Taxi Workers Alliance. He's mad. And a lot of that anger is directed right at the city.
All the negative things that we were warning was going to happen if they start selling medallions has been happening, including the bottom dropping out of the industry. And now everybody owes all this money.
Korengold got his medallion back before they cost $250,000. The city wanted to start charging for medallions, partially because it would bring in money. But also, there wasn't much turnover. Medallion holders would stick around, driving the minimum number of required hours just to keep extra income coming in from renting out their medallions to other drivers.
Well, when people get old, there's no way to exit the industry because nobody's going to just give up their income. We don't have any kind of pension plan or anything in the industry.
Things went according to the city's plan, at least at first. They brought in $60 million from selling medallions, and hundreds of longtime drivers got out of the business, netting $100 million by selling theirs. Korengold didn't know the ride-hailing apps were around the corner, but he thought that paying to transfer medallions would not be good for drivers. He spoke up at the meeting in 2012 when the MTA finalized the medallion charges.
Barry Korengold, followed by Tariq Mahmood, and he's the last person who's turned in a speaker card.
It disregards drivers who put their lives into the industry. They've been waiting 15, you know, even up to 19 years now, waiting to get their medallion. So maybe they've given up other careers like I did to get my medallion.
I spoke with over half a dozen drivers for this story, and they are all bitter. They feel burdened with decades worth of regulations by the city, and when they see an Uber or a Lyft car sailing down Market Street, it's infuriating. Korengold still drives, but it's not the same.
To tell you the truth, it's offensive to me driving around the city and seeing all these being surrounded by people doing the same thing I am, but not having to follow any of the same rules. It's offensive.
But the thing is, the city actually has little control over Uber and Lyft. Those companies are regulated by the state under the California Public Utilities Commission. That's one of the big challenges. Two sets of drivers doing almost the same thing, but under completely different agencies. The city does, of course, have control over taxis. Kate Torin is the head taxi regulator for San Francisco, and her office is, ironically, just the next building over from Uber's headquarters. She says she gets drivers' frustrations.
When somebody purchased, it was one type of operating environment till now. It's very different, so I fully acknowledge the challenges.
But she says there are lots of reasons to want to buy a medallion and drive a taxi right now. Taxis can pick up people right off the street. They can use those taxi-only lanes. Plus, they get their own stands for special events. Uber and Lyft can't do any of those things. To ease the pain, the MTA has started waiving some requirements, like the one that medallion holders have to drive 800 hours a year. But there are still 350 drivers on the waiting list to get rid of their medallions. Couldn't the city just, say, buy the medallions from those drivers?
The way the program's set up, that's not how it's structured at this time.
Torin says the city needs time to come up with solutions. That doesn't help Harpier Bat today, though. Back in his cab, he's looking for fares.
I literally never drove a Saturday morning, which is a lousy shift to make money, but here I am.
If he can find a way out of his medallion, he would leave taxis behind.
Or just find a job on the, like, working at a convenience store or, like, you know, some gas station, whatever you can do.
We drive by the Powell Street cable car turnaround.
Can I pick up this fare? I think they...
Four people are waving the cab over. I have to get out so they can all fit in. They aren't going far, but he has a loan to pay off and needs to make money one ride at a time. On Market Street, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
Kate Torin and her department are bringing a proposal to reform the medallion program to the MTA board on November 15th. The current plan is to open up the market so that anyone, not just drivers, can buy a medallion and also let purchasers be able to buy more than one medallion. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. So we've been hearing how the marketplace is adapting to the advent of ride sharing. But there are other up-and-coming tech innovations that we're just beginning to feel the full impact of, like food delivery startups. BuzzFeed News made waves at the beginning of the month when it exposed the havoc behind the scenes of a rapidly growing company called Blue Apron. The company delivers prepare-it-yourself meals to your home. All the ingredients and instructions come in a box, so you can, as they say, be the star of your own cooking show in your own kitchen. But if such a complicated operation sounds hard for a new company to deliver to customers around the country, well, it is, according to an investigative report by Carolyn O'Donovan. She's the San Francisco-based tech reporter for BuzzFeed. She says they were curious about how the food gets from farms to the distribution centers and then to our doorsteps, and who is doing that work. So she started investigating the company's Richmond location, and what she found was violence, injuries, and overworked employees. Her article is called "The Not-So-Wholesome Reality Behind the Making of Your Meal Kit." Carolyn O'Donovan came by our studios, and I started by asking her about the most sensational bit from her story, which involved a threat of gun violence at the Blue Apron facility.
I thought it was unusual. Richmond, which is pretty close to here, is a city that has historically had a problem with crime, specifically gang-related crime, and some of the people that I spoke to, including law enforcement officials, said because Blue Apron hired a lot of people locally, and a large number of them locally, which is obviously commendable, some of the tensions that exist organically in that community might have been ported into that work environment, which some people said contributed to a sort of a tense environment, which in turn led to fighting between employees. Or in the instance that the story opens with, on August 26, 2015, an individual calling and saying that they wanted to shoot their manager. So according to police records, this individual called up a supervisor at Blue Apron at 6:30 in the morning on this day and said that they were going to bring a gun to work and that they were going to shoot three different managers. That person was later arrested. It was never proven that he had a gun. But according to law enforcement officials and other folks that I spoke with, it was an event that made people nervous, that made some people feel unsafe. And it didn't help that a second person that worked at that facility was arrested later that day as a result of a totally different incident. That person had groped someone else who was working at Blue Apron. And then when he was let go as a result of that, he lashed out at the person who was firing him. Possibly also threatening to bring a gun, and he was also arrested. The general manager at the time who I spoke with described it as surreal, but it was something that stuck in people's minds.
And so violence between workers, what else did you find in your investigation?
Sure. So we started looking into other agencies, specifically looking into OSHA, and there had been one accident and a few OSHA complaints, which are triggered by OSHA inspections are triggered by anonymous complaints from from workers. So they had had a few inspections from OSHA. Through OSHA, I learned about an accident in which a worker was using a forklift, and although she was trained to use certain types of heavy machinery, she wasn't trained to use this particular forklift, and as a result, she was using it outside when the tires on it were meant for inside, and the tires were bald, and she ended up going over a depression in the cement, which OSHA felt that Blue Apron should have repaired. The forklift ended up tipping over and pinning her leg underneath her, giving her a laceration. She had to go to the hospital as a result of that, and Blue Apron did receive some fines from OSHA as a result of that, although they did contest the severity of the violations and ultimately had those reduced. And then there was an additional OSHA inspection following that in which they received more fines. And compared to other startups in the meal kit industry that we looked up, you know, Blue Apron had more violations and more fines than any of these other companies. There also was a certain element of stress linked to the rate of growth. So there were people, especially in team leader management positions, who said it was crazy, it was chaotic. One person said, I would get phone calls at 2 a.m. asking me to deal with problems in the warehouse. People working long hours.
But was that the norm, to get like the 2 a.m. calls and the 3 a.m. calls? And
late hours and push to grow really quickly is normal in a startup. I think that as a startup, what makes Blue Apron unique is that it has this large workforce of people who are earning around minimum wage in a place like Richmond, right, versus being in San Francisco. So I think it is a question of what is normal for what kind of company and what kind of work environment you're expecting.
Mm-hmm.
You have these customers who are waiting for dinner on their doorstep, and if they don't get it, they're going to be upset. They might cancel their subscription. So yes, I mean, almost everyone I spoke to said there was an enormous amount of pressure to get the boxes out the door on time. But following this period of what I would call chaos, Blue Apron, in its statement to us, did say, we slowed hiring, we slowed growth, we took intentional steps to reduce our marketing, to just try to slow things down and make sure we had everything under control before continuing to scale.
What do you think the takeaway is from your article, and like for you yourself?
For me, it's that every startup, every tech company has people inside it working for them. And in some particular cases, this particular type of startup where what you're doing is quote unquote disrupting an existing industry, be it food or manufacturing or retail, there are people who are working inside that company helping it to run. And I think just calling them up, getting in touch with them, and asking what their lives are like is interesting, and it can teach us an important lesson about business.
And what works and what doesn't work. Like, can it happen and can it make sense and at the same time be respectful of workers?
And I think another question is, can something so rooted in the real world, and I'm doing air quotes, but something that's rooted in manufacturing or food processing, something that has a lot of moving parts and is more complex than 8 or 50 or 100 people making a piece of software, can you really expect that company A to grow as quickly as company B, to scale at the same speed when you do have these extra layers of real-world complexity? Is that possible, and is it safe?
That's BuzzFeed tech reporter Carolyn Donovan. She wrote the article, The Not-So-Wholesome Reality Behind the Making of Your Meal Kit. We'll have a link to it at klw.org. Click CrossCurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. 4 years ago, UCSF initiated a clinical trial in partnership with the San Francisco Department of Aging and Adult Services and 95-year-old Mission District Institution Community Music Center. They wanted to study the impact that singing in a choir can have on older adults. The Community of Voices study follows several choirs that meet for weekly rehearsals and occasional performances. The study's built on previous work by gerontologist Dr. Jean Cohen around creativity, the arts, and aging, according to lead researcher Julian Johnson.
A publication in 2006 where he looked at older adults who sang in a choir for a year and looked at the health benefits of that, and he found that older adults who sang in the choir for a year had fewer falls, they had fewer over-the-counter medications, their morale was higher, and there was a hint that their depressive symptoms were less than the control group.
The Community of Voices study won't be complete until 2017, but choir participants are already reporting benefits to their physical, mental, and emotional health from the weekly singing groups. Here are three members of the 30th Street Senior Center Choir, which sings in Spanish, English, and Tagalog.
My name is Estela Moreno, and I am 66 years old.
I am Olinda Marti Volkov, and I am 73 years old.
My name is Lupe Bravo, and I'm 83 years old. I have always loved to sing from the time I was a little girl.
Actually, I have never sang before, not even in the shower, because I never thought that I had, you know, a voice at all.
I mean, we start with a song that never heard, and by the hour we're all singing it.
It's a sense of camaraderie, you know, enjoyment, and you feel like you feel elated, you know, because you are able, you know, to be in unity with other voices. You know, you're all together, you know, and you become friends.
La Martiniana is my favorite song because it talks about when I die, don't cry, sing for me, and then I won't be floating around you. It's a very beautiful, sentimental song, and I get emotional every time we sing it.
You know, the thing about this song is that you're also thinking about your own, you know. When you get to be a certain age, then you start thinking about your own mortality. And I think, you know, listening to this song, it makes you think about that because it makes you think of all your loved ones, all your family, your children, if you have any. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, how are they going to feel, you know, when I'm gone? And this song, you know, expresses those feelings, you know, don't cry for me.
One little lady that comes in, always a little late because she has to wait for her van, and she tries to make it. As long as she can still feel strong, that woman is there.
The first time that we sang at one of our presentations that we do is at the Day of the Death Symphony, at the Symphony Hall, Davies. And the first year that she went, I took her. I picked her up at home, you know, and I took her. When she saw that building, and when she walked into that, she'd never been. Never been. She was in awe. So she sat and like way up on the first tier one as we walked in, right there on the first seat. And from there, she stood there with her walker and she was like, I've never been. And it was just, for me, it was like, oh my God, it was the most rewarding thing, you know, to see that she was 92 then, 92 year old, you know, having this reaction to a place that she's never been and what the singing did for her.
When I see her come in, it's just, you know, there's always something that we can do no matter what age. And she still comes. And that's my future. It inspires me to continue doing and giving.
That piece was produced by Jen Chien. Community Music Center is expanding its successful older adult choir program in San Francisco and adding 3 new choirs at senior centers in the Bernal Heights, Castro, and Marina neighborhoods. The program is free for all adults 55 and over, regardless of musical experience. All the information is at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's all for us today. Our choir includes Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Leela Day, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kavulroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.